Greetings to the crew. This is your nav back again. On the 30th of July, 30th and 31st, this would be the seventh installment in the mailroom. And I would like to catch up in this installment with back mail as I've been doing. This will be the final installment looking back and reviewing mail going back to the beginning of February 2012. As I said, I have some mail in the Navigator's mailbag dating all the way back to September, but it's really not realistic or agreeable to go back and filter through all of that, so I'm going to leave it where it stands right now. So as of the next installment, Mailroom 8, I'll be responding exclusively to current mail. While I'm at it, let me point out a couple of details of my procedure here. Some of you have written and asked me about how to access audio files on Kali Rising and MetaHistory.com. Well, so far there are no audio files on those sites. I intend to post material on those sites that's outside of the Gaia Navigation Experiment. That way, all the material on Gaiaspora will be within the boundaries of the GNE. We're still holding to that agreement, okay? Also, let me explain that sometimes when you go to Gaiaspora and drop into the mailroom, you might find a new installment indicated, but with no link to the file. That's because it takes a short delay between the time I finish recording something and the time that it goes up on the site. My practice, however, is to put the title of the session on site as soon as I've done it, and there may be links and other material related to it. You can access those, obviously, as soon as they appear, but you may have to wait several hours or half a day or so before the audio file itself appears. Looking at my inbox at Navigator, on Navigator at MetaHistory.org, I see that I have about 20 current emails outstanding. And below that, I have a list of about 40 from the month of February. So I'm excited that I'll be able to clear that list out today and from the 1st of August onward, remain current with your mail. Responding in this way is really the only way that I can realistically do justice to your input. Some mails have slipped through the cracks. There are long messages from some of you that I have not been able to handle in this mailroom format, nor have I been able to respond to them in writing. So I read everything, but I don't respond to everything simply because it's not possible within the range of my attention. Also want to say that some of you write me on JLL, and I do get personal mail, which I consider outside the framework of the GNE as such, but I don't have the luxury to respond to personal mail.
Not at any length, that is.
So I may respond by a word of acknowledgement or a phrase or two, but that is really all I can squeeze out of myself based on the amount of time that I allow myself to be chained to a computer. So let's proceed back to the beginning of February. And the first mail I want to pick up is from Bobby, sending a link to the Extinction Protocol, referring to a powerful energy release emanating from the Earth's core. I've alluded to this article before. Just want to give you another hit on it. It's described as an intense three-dimensional gravitational anomaly that was recorded by geophysical stations at vast distances around the world. And it is described as a powerful energy release emanating from the Earth's core. According to the scientist, quoted, this fact may herald intensification of geodynamic processes in our planet, and as a result, a higher number of stronger earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and tsunamis, etc.
This effect was recorded in November of last year for the first time, I believe, going on around 8 months into correction. And then again, it was recorded on May 17th, 2012. Another massive blast of some kind of signal from the interior of the Earth, baffling to scientists, and all they can say about it is, well, this kind of thing shouldn't happen. We just point out that May 17th was the day when the Sun and Jupiter were in conjunction. Remember that Jupiter plays a significant role in the correction process, astrophysically speaking. It was also very close to the day, one day or two off from the moment that Venus went retrograde. We know that the retrogradation of Venus back into the bull for its second conjunction with Jupiter has been a major spectacle in the sky and a major event in correction. Has been described as the omen of deliverance. So certainly May 17th, 2012 was a moment loaded with significance for the correction process, and this again was a time when this massive signal was registered. Scientists are like just about everyone else in the world, including all of the New Age teachers and commentators, including Chris High, including all of the gurus of the day, including David Icke, including the more trustworthy ones, the less trustworthy ones. They all talk about the Earth, if they talk about it at all, either like it was the passive setting for human events, like a stage setting, dumb and passive, or as if it were a dumb globe of matter that has no sentience, no emotions, no conscience, no will, no ability to remember, no ability to foresee. I can't tell you how deep it goes, but it's obvious if you look around you, if you pay attention to what people are saying, and in particular, pay attention to what they don't say. It reminds me of the early days when I was involved with astrology, and I was stunned to realize that volumes and volumes had been written about the influences of all the planets, and nothing had been written about the influence of the Earth. I mean, that exclusion really caught my attention. So it's the same today. Scientists say this should not be happening, as if the Earth, as a living entity, should not be communicating with the Sun or the rest of the cosmos in general. Of course, in the Gaia navigation experiment, we're paying close attention to this matter. Now, I don't have a lot to say about the matter of the Earth-Sun interaction because I don't feel confident in what I could say. But the framework of the story is clear enough. The Sun has been an ally of the Aeon Sophia from very remote times, even before the formation of the Earth itself. The Sun must, in some very intimate ways, be connected with correction and be assisting and supporting the mothership in achieving her own course in the cosmos. I've suggested that the Sun is currently playing a role in bleaching out the mold of the Anthropos, the mold that is formed in the Petri dish at this point in the experiment.
So I have given some indications of the solar terrestrial interaction, but there is much, much to be learned, much to be observed. But none of it can be observed by people who remain blinded by the paradigm that tells them, that dictates to them what they can see and what they cannot see. This is the fate of the human animals caught in the archontic matrix of their own minds. Next is a mail from Paul, referring to some things I said in my talks on Gaian ethics and right action with Grok. So I quote myself here because he quotes me. I said, "You don't have to understand the sacred symbols of the Masons or the Assyrian Egyptian rites of empowerment in ancient times. All you have to understand is that the perpetrators are instruments of the suppressed power of the supernatural and irrational. The perpetrators have a magical ability to put you under their spell. They have the ability to work black magic on humanity, and they are doing so, but not for the reasons that Ike and Tessarian and others are telling you," end quote. So, you know, quite naturally, this remarks raise a lot of questions. Paul is asking these questions. What are the reasons? How do they have this ability? Why are they using black magic and so forth? And I haven't answered any of these questions. And this is something that I really can't do unless I have more of a schoolroom context in which to teach. It's extremely difficult to get into some of these subjects that I broach and to carry them out to a more elucidated level just by talking abstractly and remotely through the internet. So I regret that I cannot answer those questions because I lack the desirable context to do so. Right now, as I'm scanning through this mail, I realize that quite a bit of the mail in the February delivery was concerning the demise of Teleste.org, and that issue is certainly dead and does not require either discussion or comment, so I'm skipping over those mails. Here's a message with a link forwarded by Kundry. Cave painting near Malaga is older than the Chauvet Cave. Well, what do you think of that? Now, I remember, I think it was in December of 94, probably, when the news came out or in a French magazine of science and archaeology of this discovery of the Chauvet Cave in the Ardèche, C-H-A-U-V-E-T. And the magnificent paintings in that cave are proven to be twice as old as Lascaux, going back deeply into the, what would it be, the Upper Magdalenian? The art of an exquisite refinement of a fantastic accomplishment, more sophisticated than the art that came 10,000 or 15,000 years later. So the world was stunned by the images of the Chauvet Cave and by their style and manner in which they were achieved. And now we learned that right there in the Serenia Gironda, in that part of the world where Terma of Gaia Awakening was received, there is a cave called the Cave of Nerha, with images of seals painted more than 42,000 years ago. That is 10,000 years older than the Chauvet Cave. By the way, if you want to look on, have a tour of the Chauvet Cave, go on YouTube and search Herzog, H-E-R-Z-O-G, Cave of Forgotten Dreams. The German director Werner Herzog did a film on it, which is quite captivating. You might want to take a look at that. Anyway, my region of the world, the Sierra Nevada, now has the claim to the oldest known cave paintings on the planet. Of course, I'm sure others of you will dispute that. It doesn't really matter. I'm sure there are older ones here and there. I'm sure there are paintings and rock carvings that go back 240,000 years.
Well, I cite this article because, to me, it raises a point regarding location and the memory of the planet itself. In these ancient areas where cave paintings are found, whether it be in Australia, Spain, the Ural Mountains, or elsewhere throughout the world, this Paleolithic art, as it's called, this prehistoric art, is sort of like a tattooing on the body of the mother animal. Now, she has a very powerful memory, as all animals do. One of the exciting discoveries, long-term discoveries, that now presents itself in correction concerns the memory of the Aeon Sophia in her planetary embodiment, the memory of the Earth. And the libido of the goddess is actually intermingled with her memory of being the physical Earth. The libido is connected with her memory of being the Earth. I want to point this out in an upcoming talk on the central riddle of correction. But in regard to the Smalika Cave, I just want to say that there are places in the Earth which might be considered as special repositories for the memories of the planetary animal mother. Or to put it in an even more precise way, I think this would be better to say that they are repositories for moments of communion between the mother and the Anthropos, special moments of communion. And the deep involvement of our species with the planetary animal mother and our role of being embedded in her memory, as it were. I think that's the term I'd use. We are, in some respects, embedded in her memory. At certain places, we are embedded in her memory. And these places are commemorated by these ancient Paleolithic sites around the world. This is different from the holy places that you find, the sacred places known to all indigenous peoples. For instance, when I was in the West Country of the British Isles, in Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, I visited many sacred stone circles, many sacred wells dedicated to the underworld goddess, the area of Lake Bala in northern Wales, which is connected with the Parsifal legend, contains a number of such places. And of course, they're scattered all over Scotland, Ireland, and Wales. These places commemorate the participation of humanity in the life cycles of the goddess, in her seasonal death and rebirth process, in her menstruations through the seasons, in her flowering and seeding and blossoming and waning away and returning to quiescence and emerging again from quiescence. So throughout untold millennia of time, our species has participated in the life of the goddess in that way, obviously. And all sacred sites around the world commemorate that participation. But the most ancient Paleolithic sites represent something a little bit different. They represent the ways in which the experience of our species is embedded in her memory in a particular way. They are deposits of the planetary memory. And I think it's remarkable
that the term of Gaia Awakening was received in an area of Europe, a key area of southern Europe in regard to the end of the last glaciation. You know, I live in the southernmost south-facing valley of continental Europe. And the term of and Infinity Ridge is located in that valley, you see. And not far away, it's not in the Serenia Duranda region actually. It's more upwards toward Malaga on the coast. Not far away is this ancient cave. And there are other ancient sites and dolmens around the area of Andalusia. So it's no coincidence that the term of Gaia Awakening was picked up by someone who is living in such a region. And I know that the signal that produced the term of Gaia Awakening was not received uniquely by myself, the main Turton. I know for a fact that it was received by a number of other people simultaneously between May and August and then into October 2008. I know that, but to some degree, the manner of holding and receiving that signal is determined by the place in which the receiver was located, to get my point there. And that's why I find this article so revealing and so pertinent. Next up, an email from my colleague Dominique, founder of Cocopelli Seed Association, who has translated Not in His Image into French. He raises a really important question regarding something I said about archontic intrusion in the article Wisdom Dare. Now, I wrote Wisdom's Dare for Reality Sandwich or something like that. I can't even remember. And I never even read it after I wrote it. I don't write for Reality Sandwich or that kind of group blog anymore. I don't see Planetary Tantra propagating itself in that manner. But Dominique was a close reader and close observer of the Gnostic sacred narrative, raises this question. He says that in the article, I say, Sophia did not anticipate that the Archon ETs would try to intrude upon the strain of the Anthropos she had selected to live out her private experiment. As we have seen, this intrusion went so far as an attempt to hack the Anthropos, the human genome, but failed. Sophia and Thelete designed the genome to resist that kind of intrusion, but they did not design the human mind with sufficient resistance to the subterfuge of those same mind parasites who operate through HAL, simulation or virtual reality. Read the story for the true plot of the human condition. Our species was not sufficiently designed to repel archonic mind intrusion because our genomic design was engineered before the conditions of such intrusion arose. This happened by anomaly, a side effect of the fall of the wisdom goddess.
I mean, this is a serious fuck-up. You can perhaps understand why I don't want to write about these things anymore. I can't always think straight, or as straight as I used to, when it comes to putting things down in writing. I think more clearly now when I'm in the oral form of transmission, and I'm experiencing a lot of changes in my own NLP, which might be regarded as reflections or effects even of the divine alchemical transmutation Sophia is intending, that process of divine alchemy, which we are tracking through the perigee hits. Well, in any case, I really screwed it up here, and I really need to correct this. So let's go back and look at the syntax very closely. Sophia and Thelete designed the genome to resist that kind of intrusion. You mean archons hacking the genome? Well, certainly they did, because the archons tried to hack the genome and they couldn't. So they designed the genome against that kind of intrusion even before the archonic factor came into play in this experiment.
So what do we conclude from that? I don't know. We can say that perhaps the archontic factor is present throughout the universe, and it's not unique in our system, although the way that it arose was uniquely due to strange conditions in the trajectory of Sophia's experience. Okay. Whatever the case, the human genome is designed to resist hacking by the archons. But then I go on to say, the aeons did not design the human mind with sufficient resistance to the subterfuge of those same mind parasites. Well, that's more or less clear, I guess, but then I go and muddle it all up with the next sentence. Our species was not sufficiently designed to repel archonic mind intrusion because our genomic design was engineered before the conditions for such intrusion arose. That's wrong. That's wrongly stated. Instead of saying our genomic design was engineered before the conditions of such intrusion arose, I ought to have said that the calibration of the genome was engineered before such conditions of intrusion arose. By the calibration of the genome, I mean the dosage and consistency, the proportion, and the mix of those seven components in our genomic design: dianoia, metanoia, perinoia, and so forth. So the point that I wish to make here ought to have been made in this way. While Gnostic mythology affirms that the archons are unable to hack the actual physical human genome, that is to say, the DNA mechanism, DNA, RNA mechanism, they are able to intrude upon psychosomatic reality. They are able to intrude behaviorally because the calibration of the entire anthropic design was engineered without considering that they would arise in the specific way that they did arise prior to the emergence of the planet Earth itself, prior to the emergence of humanity upon the Earth. It was not calibrated to take into account that anomaly. So it's a very subtle point. The genome itself, physically, is protected, but the behavior that is linked to the calibration of the genome is vulnerable to intrusion. It's a very, very subtle point that Dominique picked up on here, and I really muddled it and fumbled it badly in the writing of that article, Wisdom's Dare, which I wrote sometime, I guess, who knows when, last year, for Reality Sandwich. In any case, I'm grateful for the opportunity to correct that serious glitch. Next, dated on February 14th, Valentine's Day, is a long mail from Stacy. It does allude to the telestai.org incident, but in a most amusing way, so I'll just read you the first paragraph of her mail. Hi, Nav. Happy Valentine's. Since I've come aboard, many things have shifted. I'm feeling compelled to note the chronology of events and anomalies noticed in my environment. Because Teleste went down almost as soon as I came aboard, and because apparently you were not reading the posts anyway, I would like to offer the following. The day that I received confirmation from you by email of my intention of participating in the Gaian experiment, that night a white owl landed on the telephone wires above my backyard. I reported the sighting on the forum. About 5 days later, I had another extraordinary sighting with an eagle, again in my backyard. This time the bird was perched on the telephone pole at the intersection. As he took to flight, I noticed that he had a quill in his talons, so big the weight of it was affecting his flight. This happened right after Telestai went down, but those who were running it, XNX, had friended me on Facebook, and I reported this event to them. This was one of the shortest-lived friendships, as I soon noticed both of them had unfriended me. I confronted so-and-so, but she did not feel compelled to respond, end quote. I can't tell you how many times crew members who have taken the Gayan Tantric vow have reported the immediate appearance of birds, and more often than not, white birds, such as the great white owl, sometimes even a white eagle. And in this case, interestingly enough, the epiphany, the avian epiphany that occurs synchronous with taking the vow, also happens to be a raptor. And so there is an association, there's a message in this omen that associates Gayan Tantra with the Kalika path, which is, of course, guided. The Kalika path for human animals is, of course, guided and exemplified by the predatory creatures in nature, namely the great raptor birds, the eagle, the falcon, the owl, and the great predatory cats, the felines, such as tiger, leopard, and lion. A couple of days later, on February 16th, that would be Jan Kerouac's birthday, comes an email from Jim P. He recounts his response to my shock podcast given back in those days when I was talking to Grok. And he says, I've had many experiences with Kali since you began to speak of her. I have been with her since 2001, and she has been teaching me to be a warrior. As a result, I lost any fear of death. Recently, she kept showing me the crystal dagger, but I wasn't sure. I was unsure of myself. At a time, I asked her, "Do you think I'm a warrior?" And she instantly plunged the blade into me. That cured my lack of confidence for sure. I cite this mail once again, even though it verges into the area of Kala Tantra, to assure you that I am completely open to hear from any of you who have had similar experiences. The NAV is always open to what you have to say in your objections, in your reservations, and in your and anything that you have to say regarding the issue of Kala Tantra. But I am keeping the firewall intact, and I am not going to be mingling audio files that deal with specific elements of Kala Tantra in the list of Gayaspora talks. On Gayaspora, you will only find talks exclusive to the GNE. Eventually, you can find other talks on metahistory.org. Previously, by the way, I said metahistory.com, which was an error. You can find them on my original site and on kalirising.org, but not here. Next, a mail from Dominique showing with some photos of a courting that he did after snowfall. Really beautiful. I'm going to link them to this mailroom session, so you'll see them when you come to the mailroom to hear this talk. Excuse me for the clicking and snapping there. I was just munching on some M&Ms. Next comes a mail from Stephanie, which actually comes from Pokhara Valley in Nepal, an area that I know very well. And Stephanie says, I have done the Tantra vow during the solar eclipse of the 25th of November, 2011. A great white Himalayan eagle was there, as I had not even started to do the vow, and it stayed around for a long time. There are a lot of birds here in the valley, but it was the only time I ever saw the great eagle, the great white eagle.
So there you are, yet another account of an epiphany of the animal powers of the Aeon Sophia connected with this practice. You know, it's been suggested, in fact, I was the one who suggested it myself some time ago, that we might compile accounts of the Gayan Tantric experience, that is to say, of taking the Gayan Tantric vow, that specific practice. For instance, suppose there was a feature on Gayaspora, a page where people could enter their vows so that everyone could read the vows other people have taken, read the language, the wording, and then everyone could give a specific account of what happened to them, when and where they took the vow, and what they saw, what animals, what birds appeared in the immediate proximity to that event, and so forth. And then they could also include in that photographs that they'd taken. A number of people have sent me photographs. And I thought of actually doing this, of having some way of compiling these experiences, these testimonials, as it were, testimonials of the Gayan Tantric vow. I've probably received at least 100 of them over the last 2 years. Well, I sometimes suggest things and then I myself appear to crap out. I'm not always consistent. Sometimes I propose something, later on I think twice about it and decide it's not a good idea, or it just slips my mind. I mean, this happens to me. I've got quite a lot going on my mind. If you could see the treasure shelf in my house, you'd understand what perhaps causes me to lose track of things sometimes. So I appreciate your patience and understanding in that respect. I might seem to crap out on you. I propose something and then I don't follow through. But I haven't followed through with this proposal of compiling testimonials for the Gayan Tantric vow for a specific reason. Even though a long-time reader of Metahistory and loyal crew member Jay and his partner Honey generously volunteered to handle that is to receive the mail, to receive the testimonials, and to be responsible for organizing them and getting them up on the site, I haven't moved ahead with that. Reason being that I'm sort of like Socrates in a certain way. Probably know that it's said of Socrates that he had a voice, an inner voice, that told him, no, don't do that. It didn't advise him as to what to do. It didn't elaborate. It wasn't like some channeled voice whispering in his ear telling him to do this and do that. It was just some kind of presence in his psyche that spoke in an imperative manner and at certain times told him, no, just don't do that. Do something else. And I have this voice or something comparable to it. Something told me not to do that. Now, why would that be, do you think? I mean, certainly I'm sure there's some of you out there who would love this idea and think it's a great idea. Imagine a Facebook page dedicated to testimonials of the Gayan Tantric vow. I mean, it's easily conceivable. And quite a few people would participate in that page. I personally and transpersonally do not endorse such a procedure. I now understand my own reticence better than I did a while back when I proposed this idea and then perversely failed to follow through on it. I now perceive my own reticence in this manner. We have the high privilege of living in the time when the Aeon Sophia establishes the initial conditions of her correction. And we ourselves ought to observe very carefully the initial conditions of anything that we do. Now, this term, initial conditions, you know, the syntax,
is taken from complexity theory, which used to be called chaos theory. It's a really important concept in Gaian physics and in Gaian practical magic. I strongly sense that the initial conditions for planetary tantra to be defined and developed during the period of correction ought to be extremely clear and clean and rigorous. And I am also strongly convinced that in the remaining months of correction, the remaining 20 months, and the time thereafter, that those involved in this experiment are due to discover ways to communicate, propagate, and share their experiences that do not rely on archonic media. So even though it sounds like a delightful idea to have a testimonial page on Facebook for the Gaian Tantric Vow, and who knows, it might go viral and all that kind of stuff. Well, I've said before that planetary tantra does not go viral. That is an archonic conception. That is an archonic mean. Planetary tantra operates fractally, not virally. Does not depend upon numbers. In fact, if there were 16 people on this planet who totally incorporated planetary tantra and made it real and active in every single moment of their life, living within the framework of her story, that would be enough to assure human participation in her correction. It's not a matter of numbers. It's not a matter of quantity. It's a matter of intensity. So that's why I've hesitated to do that. I'm not going to condemn anyone if they undertake to do that. You're free to do whatever you like. Perhaps for you it would be a great idea. But I do not stand behind that. And I ask you all to look very cautiously and carefully at how planetary tantra is going to be propagated now and in the immediate future. Our experiments with Channel 16 throughout the remainder of this year are bound to tell us a lot, to tell us and teach us a lot regarding this question. So hold on to your cookies, to use that phrase that I enjoy so much, and don't get your panties in a twist. I also like that phrase. And let's just see what means correction itself provides to us to propagate this practice and to spread the message of Sophianic wisdom across the planet. Let's just see. And let's not assume that we have to count on archonic devices to do it. Next comes a message from dedicated crew member Kathy, who writes me often, asking about who's on shift. She follows the Dakini shifts very carefully, and I think she's developing into something of a powerful Dakini herself. Here she describes the visitation of owls around her house, and she describes the way she was inspired by a close observation of their behavior. She writes, "They lighted together and then got very close to each other, puffed up their feathers, and looked as if they became one, like a big butterball." End quote. Well, that reminded her of the carnal embrace of the Anthropos at that moment. And so, lacking a partner, she did the natural thing, which was to strip down and lay on the ground. Because you can always bond with the earth, and you can always do the carnal embrace with the ground beneath your feet. So I'd say Kathy has some really healthy instincts going there. You know, this business about the owls comes up a lot. And let me clarify one more thing regarding this power animal, this power bird. I've said that the lynx-faced owl is specifically the guardian of the Gaia navigation experiment and the protector of Kalatantra. This bird sort of stands at the portal of Kalatantra and looks down into the Gaia navigation experiment, protecting its members, but it also stands over the portal, welcoming those into the path of Kalika practices. Whenever I picture the owl guardian, or not whenever, but sometimes when I picture the owl guardian, it makes me think of that notorious owl that is said to stand over the lake at Bohemian Grove. And perhaps some of you know about this creature who is associated with the biblical spirit of Moloch. And so it's said by those who present themselves as enemies of the New World Order that the predators gather at Bohemian Grove each summer and do a ceremony in worship of this owl, this huge statue of an owl. I guess it's about 20 feet tall. And this is all very woo-woo, black magic, satanic domination of the world kind of stuff. But in fact, it's just Mickey Mouse bullshit. What is the power of the Moloch owl of Bohemian Grove compared to the owls that are flying around Kathy's backyard? What is the difference? Well, many people, particularly one of them that I find sophomoric and unfortunately naively ludicrous, would be Freeman. Many people, such as Freeman, would lecture you for 4 hours on the deep occult significance of the Bohemian Grove owl. I'll give you a 30-second analysis of the deep subliminal messages contained in the figure of this owl. Are you ready? Here, I'm looking at the second hand of the clock. It reaches 12. Here goes, 30 seconds. The Moloch owl of Bohemian Grove represents the predatory greed of globalist psychopaths who want to run the world and who share a common credo, which is, it all depends on who you know, who, like the hoot of an owl. And those of us who know each other and who are in the domination game don't give a hoot about anyone else. And that is why we worship the owl, because it reminds us that we don't give a hoot. There, that was 30 seconds. That commentary on the Bohemian Grove owl is just about the best that you're ever going to hear on the internet. And you can take all the rest of it and shove it into a pipe and smoke it. Because everything that attributes magical and occult power to that owl, or to the owl that is supposedly hidden in the engraving of the American dollar bill, or to the owl that is supposedly represented in the layout of certain avenues and streets in Washington, D.C., everything that you can contribute to that by way of attributing occult power to the predators is a mind fuck that you're perpetrating on yourself. And we in Planetary Tantra don't go there. There's only one source of power in power animals, be they symbolic, be they iconic, be they statues, or be they actual birds flying around in the sky. There is only one source of real magical power in power animals and power birds, and that is the planetary animal mother herself. It's true that I've said that the globalist predators operate through a kind of black magic. I've said that. But I don't mean it in the same sense that Ike means it, or Michael Tsarian, or Jordan Maxwell, or people of that ilk. Not at all. It's very easy to understand. It's relatively easy, I should say, to understand the black magic and satanic operations of the globalist predators if you understand what is called the repression of the irrational and supernatural factors in the human psyche. In Planetary Tantra, you are invited to play with the transrational, paranormal, and supernatural powers of this world. You are invited to play with them harmlessly for your joy, for your pleasure, for your enrichment, enlightenment, and abundance. As a matter of fact, the globalist predators do not draw on those same powers at all, which are the only genuine powers of magic on the planet. The magic of all that lives, the magic of the living dream, of the divine aeonic animations of this planet sustained by Sophia herself. That is the real magic. So where from then do the globalist predators who worship the Moloch owl draw their power? They draw their power from their denial and repression of that very same magic. So the primary magic is ours to enjoy. The magic that they use is, as it were, perversely derived from the repression of our primary magic. And that is the only way it can work. The more that the human animal claims back its primary magic by interactivity with the planetary animal mother, and now with the whole range of galactic aeons, the more the human animal does that, the less power the globalist predators and the interspecies predators will be able to wield over society. To a huge extent, the power that they wield over society is not magical. There's almost nothing magical in it at all. It depends on force, and it depends on the enforcement of a false narrative upon the minds of the populace. The false narrative of 9/11, for instance. The false narrative of the recent Batman theater shooting in Colorado. The false narrative. Within 20 minutes, 2 hours of an event happening, the false narrative is already up and running. The false narrative of Jewish psychology, rooted in Freud. The false narrative of public relations mind manipulation, developed by Edward Bernays, was related to Freud, was, I believe, the nephew of Freud's mistress, Minna Bernays, or perhaps Freud's nephew himself, I can't remember. The domination of the narrative of the hero by Hollywood films, the domination of the narrative of social change by Zionist media. This is the magic. These are the methods of magic of the globalist perpetrators. But this is not real magic. It's just manipulation. It's mindfuck. So it's always important to bear in mind that the birthright of the human animal is a connection to the magic of the planetary animal mother, the earth, the planet, our source, the aeon, the animating presence of this moment. And that everything else is a false and fraudulent construction in denial of that. But the denial is very strong. And the denial builds up and crusts and grows in layers over many aeons, or I should say many generations, not aeons, over many generations of time. And breaking through that denial, the crust of denial of our true magical endowment as animals, that's what's happening right now as I speak. That's what the planetary shift is about. And that is the way that human society can possibly be radically transformed and rapidly transformed in keeping with Sophia's correction. Returning now to the mailbag to pick up, say, the mail of the last week of February. I'm getting down to the end here. Here's a brief note from Dame Miriam pointing out the fact that scientists detect with their instruments, are detecting lately, certain changes in the spin velocity of certain planets, in this case, Venus. And she raises the question, this article perked my interest as to the possibility of Gaia Sophia's influence on the other planets. Even though Venus is not directly involved with Gaia Sophia's correction at this point, as you say, I thought this was an interesting observation. The article she quotes says, according to National Geographic News, that this puzzle has not yet been solved, but there appears to be an exchange of angular momentum between Venus and the Earth, and that may be a possible cause for Venus spinning more slowly. A moon, for example, can cause a planet to rotate more slowly than expected because both objects share angular momentum. End quote. Well, this is certainly relevant to correction. It's true that I haven't spoken specifically of the role of the inner planets, Venus and Mercury, in correction. Not astronomically, at least. The role of Venus, presenting the omen of remembering and gathering in March and the omen of deliverance in July, is, of course, crucial to correction. Crucial to tracking correction, I should say. So Venus is certainly involved. I've had less to say about Mercury. I just want to reiterate, spinning off from this article forwarded by Miriam, that the Aeon Sophia can do anything she wants with the solar system and within the solar system. If she hasn't broken completely free from the solar system now and become a free-floating planet that establishes her own orbital relationship to the sun, it's because she doesn't want to. And I suspect it's because she doesn't want to do anything that produces massive catastrophic upheaval of the seas and continents. She doesn't want to do that. Why should she want to do that? If she's in the critical moment of correcting this experiment and it's in its last phase in this kalpa, the last 11 minutes of the day, if she wants to save the experiment and carry it over to the next day, she's not going to go into the lab and wreck everything. Well, she is the lab, so she's not going to wreck herself pulling out of the solar system in some kind of catastrophic manner. I don't see that as being at all consistent with her character or her purposes and motives. But while she is still relatively included within the solar system, she can borrow the angular momentum of other planets. She can affect it. She can slow down or speed up the moon. She can slow down and speed up the motions of the other planets by very small increments. Extremely small increments is all that she requires. It's a micro-incremental process of adjustment that has macro effects. This is how she works in the framework of celestial mechanics of the archonic system. Also bear in mind, folks, that the solar system only consists of the sun, Mercury and Venus, the two inner planets, meaning they are within the orbit of the Earth, and Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, the three planets outside the orbit of the Earth. So the orbit of Saturn is, technically speaking, in Gaian terms, the limit of the solar system. There are only five planets in addition to the Earth itself. Okay? Let's keep it simple, folks. The trans-Saturnian planets, which would be Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, as well as the small asteroid-type planet Chiron, which navigates back and forth between Saturn and Uranus, special case. These bodies do not belong to the solar system proper. In fact, the outermost planets are not planets at all in the sense of the inner ones, but they are probes that have actually been set in place by the pleuromic eons for observing the trans-temporal or diachronic developments in the ongoing experiment with the Anthropos. I would have a lot to say about this, but I would have to do it with people present in some kind of class situation where we're talking about Starbase and that sort of thing. So if that opportunity comes up one of these days, I'd be happy to talk a little more about this fascinating point I'm making. But for right now, just understand, take Jupiter, for instance. The correction of the Aeon Sophia takes place in the apsides of Jupiter. Planet Jupiter may be considered as a tugboat, which has played a role in the first year of correction of pulling the mothership into position to assume self-propulsion and self-navigation. I've described this in some detail. The Aeon Sophia gave to the Archons the power they use to erect and maintain the planetary system, and she can reclaim that power and use it for her own purposes any time she likes and in any way she likes. As I'm going through the final week of mail in February, I'm coming across a number of long mails from Onome, from John, from other people. I have to put these long mails in a long mail file. I do read them, and I read them more than once. Some from Julie F., from Keith, and also from Miguel. I just can't respond to these long mails without a long session of writing, which I am unwilling to do. But I do have them. I put them aside here and refer to them when it's appropriate. What I would like to do in the remaining 10 minutes of this session is complete the back mail of February right up until the last entry. And then from then on, we'll be current. Here is a message from Kevin on February 25th, in which he says, "I thought you would find this interesting. I remember the show on Discover or Nova about spore-like cells of extinct bison being brought back to life." And then I'll quote his paragraph here. I love this. Love this one. "Spore-like cells remain viable in unprepared tissue using no special preservation techniques, frozen at minus 86 centigrade and then thawed or heated to 85 centigrade for more than 30 minutes. This has led researchers to try to revitalize spore-like cells from tissue samples of frozen carcasses deposited in permafrost for decades, frozen walrus meat more than 100 years old, and mammoth and bison in Alaska estimated to be 50,000 years old. Certain scientists believe that these unique cells lie dormant until activated by injury or disease, and that they can have the potential to regenerate tissues lost to disease and damage. Because the cell size is less than 5 micrometers, which seems rather small, it seems rather small to contain the entire human genome. But the authors speculate on the concept of a minimal genome that could be embedded in these cells." End quote. Well, presto porpoise. What does that tell you? I've been talking about transspeciation. It's one of the hot-button issues of correction. I've been talking about how the Divine Sophia tags individual specimens and actually preserves their DNA record in order to regenerate the human species, to regenerate the Anthropos in a further chapter of this experiment. So this is currently happening. Anthropos 10 is being recalibrated and transmuted by this process into Anthropos 11. The manner in which we have been seeded on this planet in the first place, and the manner in which all types of animal life forms, insects, serpents, and birds, not to mention flowers and plants, the manner in which they can be carried over from one kalpa into another after a period of suspended animation is vividly intimated in this passage of current science. So there you go. Spore-like cells. Lynn Margulis called them propagules, and she believed that the seeds of life on this planet were brought here through interstellar space in the form of these freeze-dried propagules. So this is the picture that begins to emerge in your mind and even in your own memory, because you remember it through this, the phylogenetic circuits of memory. There is a way of remembering through the transpersonal phylogenetic circuits of the entire species. It's not your personal memory, how the spawn of the Anthropos landed on this planet and first evolved into tuberous plants. No, but it is a memory you can have. And right now, Mar recently asked me, it's a crew member in Mallorca, when are you going to start talking about the south node of the moon and its convergence with the planet Jupiter in the bull and the significance of all this in the pattern of correction? Well, I'm talking about it right now. The south node, the nodes of the moon, south and north, which have an 18.6-year retrograding cycle, indicate something in the metabolism of the divine memory of Sophia. Memory has a metabolism. It has a cycle of digestion, just like the human body does. And the digestion and assimilation of memories and the transformation of those memories into food for consciousness is timed by the lunar nodes. So we are right now, those of us in this experiment, are in the position to begin to remember more than we could possibly know as individual human animals. I have a lot more to say. This is one of the most exciting prospects facing us right now. I have a lot more to say about this in the very near future. Well, with that comment, my friends, there remains only one email from February from John concerning kimberlite locations in Canada. And with my response to that, I brought myself up current with our mail. So the next mailroom session, number 8, will be all current mail within the last week or 10 days. You may recall that I suggested that the possible means of exit for Mantis would be through the so-called kimberlite channels in South Africa. But there are also kimberlite channels in Ontario, Canada, interestingly enough. I think it's fascinating that these kimberlite pipes, as they're also called, exist in both hemispheres. No one knows, I certainly don't, how Mantis is going to get out of this planet so she can go and breed with the massive Mantis colony in the larger Magellanic Cloud. I don't have any idea if she will get out or can get out, or some of us are looking at this aspect of the Sophianic scenario very closely. Others are ignoring it. Some of you, I would suppose, find the Mantis episode a little bit too far and too fantastic to follow. However, I would say keep an open mind. We'll never know what might be revealed about Mantis in the next few months. It's possible that Mantis could not leave. It's possible that Mantis could be preserved in ice or preserved in amber. Perhaps the Aeon Sophia is considering that option, of flooding the interior geode chamber of the earth with something like amber, which is a resin, plant resin, and thereby preserving the Mantis in amber and allowing the Mantis to be resurrected at a later time in conditions more suitable to its desires. It's fascinating to contemplate Mantis. Some of you really like this subject. You've sent me interesting comments about it and links. and suggestions of what might be happening. The fate of Manus is one of the more suspenseful episodes in Correction. And I look forward, as I think you all do, to some startling revelations about that in the months to come. So that's it for this session. So you're now signing off. Be picking it up at the beginning of August, starting tomorrow, with more responses from the mailroom and a NAV briefing on the subject of the central riddle of correction.